So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the search for the brightest isolated neutron stars. I should say isolated old neutron stars, searching for them in the X-ray, not the radio, since that's the easy way to do it. The basic argument for this is that, based on nuclear synthetic grounds, one expects something on the order of 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9 neutron stars in the galaxy. We see about 1,000 of these as radio pulsars, about 10% of those, another, what do you need?
The pointer.
Oh, another 10% of those as X-ray binaries, and that leaves about 10 to the 9 left to discover. It's a good question of where they are. We'd like to observe them. These sources that we see are really 1 in a million sources. We're seeing the tail end of the distribution here, and a lot of the neutron stars that are worth studying are still out there to be discovered. And so what's interesting to study about isolated neutron stars, or any neutron stars, is that basically their spatial distribution, magnetic field strength, kick velocity, spin distribution, that tells us something about their formation and evolution. In addition, it'd be good to get X-ray spectroscopy. One could learn about the contents of their atmosphere, potentially say something about their equation of state, when you know what the redshift is from the surface. Significant fraction of the hydrogen burning
stars in our galaxy actually been individually observed? My impression is that the fraction is actually about the same, or perhaps even a little bit less.
That's probably true.
Is that because they're not detectable, or because they...
Your point is that that's the point.
We see them in external galaxies, though.
We do see them in
drawings. Wow. No, you're right. Suddenly I'm feeling very fatalistic. I think I should quit right now. No. The neutron stars that we do see are observed because they're easy to observe. They either have strong enough magnetic fields, strong enough, are spinning fast enough that they can be detected as radio pulsars, or they're accreting X-ray binaries, or we happen to run into them otherwise. And I'm going to mention that there have been past theoretical studies.
I guess you could call this a call for normal, but a search for normal neutron stars, and it would sound a bit more.
Yeah, that's true.
You don't know any.
Sure. So there have been, the first prediction, it was early on, pointed out that if you have isolated old neutron stars wandering around the galaxy, that they could be, accreting from the interstellar medium. If you just take a sort of a vanilla velocity distribution and assume that they are accreting from the interstellar medium through Bonnie-Hoyle accretion, the zeroth order estimation is that there should be on the order of 2,000, 10,000 isolated neutron stars detectable in the ROSAT All-Sky Survey. This has been modified since those early predictions. The predictions now, take into account newer, perhaps more reasonable velocity distributions in the neutron stars, kind of bring those numbers down to the 100 to couple thousand level, but still, we only have 7 good candidates. 2 of them have been optically confirmed for the isolated neutron stars. So there really is kind of a disparateness between the number of isolated neutron stars that should be detectable in the ROSAT Bright Source Catalog or the ROSAT All-Sky Survey and the number that have been observed. So the question is, why should one search for the brightest X-ray neutron stars? And the answer is simple. It's the easiest way to get X-ray spectroscopy of the neutron stars. You have faint ones, it's harder to get high singleton noise observations. And on top of that, if the fainter you go in X-ray, the more difficult it is to confirm that the source is an isolated neutron star optically. Basically, the argument that's made to detect an isolated neutron star is you get a position for it, and you look in the error box of that X-ray source, and you see if there are any optical sources that give you an X-ray to optical flux ratio of 10 to the 4 or less. If you do, then it could very well be something like a white dwarf, AGN, or a normal star, depending on what the X-ray to optical ratio is. And basically, at the ROSAT Bright Source Catalog limit, the magnitude at which this constraint kicks in is around 30th magnitude. So if you go much fainter, then it becomes rather difficult to argue on the basis of the X-ray to optical flux ratio. That makes it difficult to use Chandra serendipitous sources, for example. I mean, of course, you can detect much, much fainter fluxes, and the positions are actually quite superior to the ROSET PSPC all-sky survey, with Chandra positions being arc-second, PSPC positions being more like 12 arc-seconds. Really cuts down the error box, so the identification is almost trivial with Chandra. But then again, it's more difficult to argue that any of the serendipitous sources will be isolated neutron stars.
Can you get a tell us how many of the bright source catalog there are with such colors to allow
No. Okay. No, I'm not. But it's a good question. But I'll have other arguments to talk about, I mean, which hint around to that. Those which have been detected, or at least are proposed as either candidates or confirmed sources, this is from a recent review by Trevis and Colpe. Basically, so these are the seven. The ROSAT PSP count rate, the bright source catalog, the count rate limit in the ROSAT bright source catalog is about 0.05 counts per second. This one was discovered with Einstein. They all are very soft spectra. Indeed, that's one of the arguments that the sources are isolated neutron stars and why they're pursued. Around 200 EV or lower, you notice also that they tend to be among the brighter sources, 3 PSPC counts per second, 1.7. 0.1, 0.1 PSPC count per second. So,
the first one is almost certainly not a neutron star.
Yeah, that's been argued, yeah, by Neuhauser and Trumper, right? Is that what you're referring to?
Not only. There are some that I don't remember. Mm-hmm. A couple. Yeah. Because the big question mark. But what is the most plausible candidate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's pretty much. I mean, that's a good. So it's a good example to show, you know, how the decision is made whether or not these objects are isolated neutron stars. The arguments for one of these objects being isolated neutron star is usually thrown out there by the X-ray to optical ratio. But then on top of that, the pursuit of the objects is more or less done along the lines of whether or not there are plausible counterparts that are within the error box. For that reason, most of these detections, actually all of them, have been made pretty much serendipitously. You know, this was a serendipitous Einstein source. The 3 count and 1 count per second sources were bright, and so they were pursued with the HRI to produce a much better position. Let's see here. This one, 0420, was originally thought to be a galaxy because it was spatially proximate to a galaxy. And so they went after it with the HRI, found that the position ruled out the galaxy and left a error box which was empty of optical sources to a X-ray to optical flux limit of about 2 times 10 to the 4.
How about the ages?
Excuse me?
Age. Age of the sources.
Mm-hmm. So they'll. Excuse me?
Pido.
Yeah. So there are arguments that surround the ages. I'm not going to talk about those this morning.
Oh, so you don't know.
There's only one measured and it's not published. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think this is.
Oh, you all don't know ages. Ages estimated.
That one, I believe, is Fred Walters who makes an argument for.
That's the only one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
That's
yeah.
The only one.
Well, Martin, you have a...
This 1308 has a... Mm-hmm. Is it 1308 or RBS 1223?
Yeah.
Has a B and a P-dog measure.
Has a
B and a P-dog.
Yeah.
So this is part of the age estimate.
That would be this one, which is based on Fred Walters' proper motion.
Yeah, okay.
And Martin's also the optical source that Martin's done work with. It's the PMP dot. Yeah, I'm not sure which one that is, but the 1227, this one here?
I think it's this 0308, but I'm not sure. Oh, yeah. No, it's 0806, sorry. Right. It's the bottom one.
We don't have a PMP dot, so it doesn't know where it is.
Right. 5.6
in the second period.
So I'll refer you to the review by Trevis, who can give you full details on that.
It's published?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is from the review. Okay. So, going on, these are these two, 1308 and 1605, were found in the Rosette Bright Source Bright Survey, which was a survey to look at 2,000 objects with count rates greater than 0.2 PSPC counts per second, try to identify those. Also 806 down here, this last one, is a relatively new one. It hasn't been studied very well. It was found serendipitously around the supernova remnant, and it's in the process of being investigated.
What is the last column?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to come back to that. Okay. That's actually an interesting number. I'll tell you right now that this is a probability of identification with optical sources on the basis of statistical ground, but that's more along the punchline of the talk.
Am I right in thinking that only two of these were detected from the... They were all
affected
with point source, HLI
pointings.
Except for those two.
All of these sources, all but two of the sources were detected in the Rosette Bright Source Catalog.
But they weren't singled out as interesting from the Bright Source Catalog.
They were not. They were pursued with HRI, and after an HRI position was obtained for all of them, then the small error boxes is what allowed them to argue that there were... That a high X-ray to optical ratio source was required.
Mm-hmm. No, because 1605 was picked out particularly because it was a soft black source. That's why they obtained the HRI observation, so this is not completely true.
And no one has really gone through the Bright Source Catalog systematically like you are.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are people who have picked out regions of the sky for other reasons, or for similar reasons, actually, and went source by source and argued. That's kind of what I'm talking about here. This is a review done recently by Neuhauser and Trumper. They wanted to put limits on the actual observed distribution of isolated neutron stars detected with Rosette, or at least... be able to put limits on them. These are studies that they point to. Hamburg Quasar Survey, Galactic Plane Survey of Cygnus, the Northern Area Survey, High Latitude, Molecular Clouds, Donner et al. Also did high latitude sources, and some very bright soft sources from the Rosette Bright Source Catalog. And all of these basically look for optical counterparts or other sorts of counterparts that are in the error box of the sources, and if they find one, a plausible one, they then count that as the counterpart, and the ones that are left act as provide a rough number of what they consider an upper limit for the number of isolated neutron stars in the sky. This is a comparison that Neuhauser and Trumper made between the published predictions for isolated old neutron stars in the Bright Source Catalog. This is the PSPC counts per second. This is the number per unit solid angle. This is the original Trevisan-Kolbe 91 initial prediction with low absorption and high absorption. You can see that for most of the limits that these works have come out with, and certainly for the small number of detections, Neuhauser and Trumper used about four actually as plausible detections, that these sorts of numbers are ruled out by these limits. Madame Blaise have a modified distribution where they include, in addition to normal accretion, they have diffusive heating of the neutron star population so that the neutron star population spatial distribution isn't exactly confined to the plane. And this predicts substantially fewer sort of isolated neutron stars, down to a limit of about 100, 10 to 100 or so at the limit of the Rosette Bright Source Catalog count right here. So that's really what exists. The question one is left with is exactly how precise these upper limits are, and how do you really know what it is that you're placing a limit on. The problem with the approaches that have been taken is that generally, as I said, what's done is that a point is taken in the sky which is the position of the X-ray source, and searching for a possible counterpart in the error region can actually be kind of hairy. Source confusion, particularly among optical sources, is the dominant problem. in identifying which object you're looking at. And in the end, you can't really say absolutely that what you're looking at is definitely the source unless you argue for it on some sort of statistical ground. This is an example of one of the Rosette Bright Source Catalog X-ray sources. It's the best position is in the center. The one sigma radius around 22 arc seconds. And these are all the optical sources that you find in the area here. So the question is, which one is it? If one of the previous surveys confronted with a source like this, they would basically either take spectra or they would identify it, the different optical sources photometrically as either a low-mass star or an AGN or a white dwarf or a galaxy. And if it's in the known population, then if it has a not unreasonable X-ray to optical ratio for that population, that's considered to be an identification. That's a perfectly reasonable approach. It's not very quantitative. It leaves leaves great uncertainty about the reliability of such identifications. And one can really ask whether or not, you know, a source, for example, here might be more likely than this source here because it's relatively brighter. But also because it belongs to, you know, but also it may also belong to a population which makes it a more likely counterpart. In essence, it's a subjective way to go about identifying the X-ray sources, and it makes it difficult to really estimate what the upper limit is on the number of isolated neutron stars that have been identified. So I'll just mention that all those sources that I just showed you, later on in this talk I'll show you the probabilities of association between the optical sources that are in that image and the X-ray source that's in the center. So what I'm going to tell you about now is an approach to identify the brightest isolated neutron stars in the Bright Source Catalog. We're starting with the Bright Source Catalog, which is around 18,000 sources, full sky, in 0.1 or 0.4 to 2.4 keV energy range. It's a flux limit of about 10 to the minus 13 Earth per second. Position uncertainty is around 12 arc seconds. These are from the All Sky Survey. And the approach is to use an off-band catalog for the cross identifications. The one I'm going to describe to you this morning, I'm going to talk about the published work in cross identifying the X-ray sources with the optical sources in USNOA2. The difference between this approach and previous approaches is that we're going to use a strictly quantitative approach, which is statistical. We're going to calculate the probability of an identification between the X-ray source and the optical counterpart or possible optical counterparts that are in the field. We're also going to calculate the probability of non-identification of the X-ray source. So we'll know, based on this argument, what the probability that the X-ray source itself is none of the objects in the field. And finally, we have a program in which we take the X-ray sources, which have a probability of no identification of greater than around 90%. We're going to obtain Chandra 1 arc second positions and search for high X-ray to optical ratio sources among those. The method is really straightforward. So we have an X-ray field in which there's an X-ray source in the center of it. And we take sort of some arbitrary radius. It doesn't matter what size the radius is. We use, except for the fact that you want to more or less ensure that the optical source that is the counterpart is in it. So it needs to be somewhat larger than the uncertainty. And we use 150 arc seconds. And so you have these X-ray sources, and you have this X-ray source here, and then you have all these optical sources here. And they have different distances, and they have different magnitudes. They have some distance from the X-ray source field center. The positional uncertainty, or the uncertainty in the distance between the two sources, is known based on the optical position and the X-ray position. And we also have the magnitude of each of these sources from the USNO-02 catalog. We use the B magnitudes. The approach is to calculate for each X-ray to optical pair this figure of merit. It's not really a probability, but it's optimal actually when it is a product of probabilities. And we want to use all the information that we have available to us. The information that we have available are the positions and the magnitude brightness. And so basically we calculate this function, which looks like a product of the probability distribution of, you know, a possible counterpart or definite counterparts around the X-ray source in position, and 1 over the number distribution of B magnitude for sources in background fields. So basically this
distribution of the number distribution of sources in background fields, you do on the same plate or near that same
circle? Yeah, what we do is not in the same circle. What we do is we offset 9 fields, or 8 fields actually, identical in size, basically Monte Carlo around the source. So the background fields are taken from immediately around the source.
Because obviously the B magnitude in the ELA scenario, it's probably okay, place by place, but certainly not three plates.
Certainly, yes. And actually, for reasons that will become clear, and if it doesn't, then raise the issue again, it doesn't really matter how bad the B magnitudes are, and it doesn't actually matter how bad the positions are. What does matter is that you're using a uniform catalog.
Okay.
If you are using uniform catalog, then you won't misidentify anything. You just will have poor identifications. So once we calculate this, we call this a likelihood ratio. Once we calculate this, we make a histogram of the LR values that are calculated for optical sources that are in the fields, and separately for the LR values of the optical sources that are in the background fields. And after that, we can calculate a probability, which we call a reliability. And that probability is found by taking the difference between the number of sources in the source field and the number of sources in the background field at some value of the likelihood ratio divided by the number of sources in the source field. You can see that if there are equal number of objects in the source field and background field, that this probability is zero. If you have many more sources in the source field than you have in the background field, this probability is one. So it's just a histogramming argument. It's basically a cluster analysis. So finally, after you calculate that probability, you can calculate the probability that a particular optical source I is the unique association with the X-ray source, that is, the exclusion of all the other sources in the field. And that probability is just proportional to the product of the reliability of that source, Ri, times the product of 1 minus the reliabilities of all the other sources in the field. Basically, it's the argument that it's the probability that it is the source and the probability that it's none of the other objects. Okay. So once you're done with that, you can also calculate the probability that the X-ray source is none of the objects in the field, and that's just the probability that it is none of the other sources, 1 minus the probability that it is the source.
And these have to be suitably normal. So at the end of it, what we end up with is, for each of the X-ray sources, probability that of identification between the X-ray source and the optical source. And we end up with the probability of no identification, that the X-ray source has no counterpart in the USNO 18 catalog. So the upper limit on the number of isolated old neutron stars is just going to be that the sum of the probability of no identification, because that source shouldn't be here.
Have you performed a reality check here, so those sources which have high PID, comma I, and low P, no ID, when you look at them, it's obvious that you do know what the counterpart is. I mean,
that kind of harkens back to yes and yes, but I would caution you from relying on your intuition. Because intuition isn't really very helpful.
I guess experience is not just
a question. The optical field is 150 arc seconds. Aren't in every field you could be?
That's a question. That's a very good question.
How can any individual source have a significant probability of its own thing?
So this is what you end up with. What we do is we calculate these likelihood ratios for all the on-source fields and also all the background fields. But what you end up with is that the objects that are far away from the X-ray source, there are just as many in the background field as there are in the source field. So at some value of the likelihood ratio, the probability that any of those are associated is zero. But what happens is you get closer and closer, just based on spatial proximity and optical brightness, you get an excess in your histogram in the on-source field. And so basically, because you're taking the difference between this curve and this curve, dividing it by this curve, you end up with a probability which is non-zero. And that increases as you, you know, get brighter sources and sources that are closer to the fewest sample. So you can see here that out here, there's a rather noticeable excess of sources in the on-source field above those that are in the background field. And when we take the difference between these two distributions, calculating reliability, we find that there are, you know, a large number of sources which have probabilities that are close to one, and the ones that have less so. Now, these are interesting, of course, but for our purposes, these are equally interesting. And the reason is that if you have fields which have, you know, sources in them with probability of around 20% of association, well, it's one out of five. Those aren't really looking at. But the four out of five of them, they're not associated with the X-ray source, the opposite sources associated with the X-ray source. We need to count these just as much as we need to count these. And so we also need to know what this value is, which is why we calculate.
But you're not using any other information like X-ray colors or.
No, this I should tell you that our motivation in starting this is actually to perform statistical identification.
Yeah, completely blind.
Right.
Right.
So we're actually just looking for what the optical identification is in these sources right now.
You realize that you have holes in the US and LA too, Catalog. I mean, they're small, but the globular clusters are solid.
Absolutely. We actually find a number of longer clusters that are associated with them. After we performed all this, the ones that had no possible counterparts, we go back and we look at the plates optically, we find things like F31, 47 psi. So those have to be taken out. We have a list of those, and we will. They're around 40, I think, almost about,
something like that. Yeah, I mean, the holes are small, but,
yeah. You don't want to look for an isolated neutron star.
Absolutely.
Well, you might want to, but.
So do you understand the statistics of false positives? In other words, if you were just to analyze background fields only, how many times you would get, you know, probability greater than a half or greater than 0.7?
It's actually almost never. If you were to look at background fields only, you know, we look at this, what happens is that you just don't have a statistical, you know, you just don't have a statistical excess over the number that you expect in your background field. It's roughly, so the question is, not exactly, but it's comparable to what is the uncertainty in the calculated probabilities. And that depends on where one is on this curve, because that also depends importantly on the number of sources that one has in any individual bin. And basically up near the above the 90% level, the uncertainty is at the few percent level, 2 to 3.
But you combined 8 fields, right?
Excuse me?
The background fields are combined.
The background fields are all combined, that's correct. So it's not just the 8 fields themselves, it's actually the 8 times 18,000 fields that comprise the background fields.
I guess my question is not so much whether you've got the background exactly right. Probably you could take as many background fields as you want and hone those statistics. The question is, when you have a single realization of the field that you're examining, it's got some noise, and then it's going to produce some deviation from the background. Do you understand this?
That's on the order of a few percent. For the very high probability ones, of course, it's actually much smaller. It's on the order of less than that. It's half a percent or less. And that's because we have so many more, you know, high likelihood ratio sources than background sources. That doesn't really matter much. Okay. So the result of all of that, just so that you know, is something which looks like this. This is the cross identification catalog. It's the or one page from it. It's around 200 pages long. These are the sources, or these are some of the sources that have probabilities of identification of 98% or better. You can see they're all relatively bright, as you can see. These are, some of them have USO magnitudes as low as 11.4. 1.5, that's about the limit of where.
The zeros is where the Tychon magnitude is, right? So yeah. It's just
the zeros are where the USNOA2 plate scanning mechanism fails to get a good photometric magnitude. They just substitute the zero. So we don't know what the magnitude is, but we do know that there are just as many, or we do know how many there should be in the background practice. And there are many more in the on-source field, and that's what's surprising, right off the sources.
Did you restrict these to your localized latitude?
I'm way over.
Well, it's because you've been interrupted, sorry.
No, actually, no.
So I'm just wondering why there are no AGN counterparts at all, or very few extra-galactic.
The AGNs tend to kick in actually at around 14, 15, 16 magnitude. Uh-huh. They tend to be less likely sources, simply because in terms of raw numbers, the sky is dominated by stars, at least in the bright levels, at the bright numbers. If we had an all-sky spectroscopic survey, one could do the same statistical argument and include the information of AGN and stars, and that would be a superior way to do it.
Actually, principally, we do the same thing on the Hamburg phase survey, right? They do, in some sense, have that, although it's a little bit limited.
They don't actually do a background estimation of the number of objects that they have.
No, I mean, you could use your technique on that survey, but then including the information that you have some spectrum.
They would need to observe a number of background fields in order to get the estimate for the number of set sources that are classified the way that they have.
You mean they have not classified all of them? Only these error boxes.
They classify the ones that are in the error boxes. Fair enough. So we need to have some sort of control fields to do that.
So how many of these are ones that are new?
So these P's here are ones that are listed in SIMBAD as having previously been identified. These are the sources names that appear next to this USNL A2 position within 10 arc seconds in the SIMBAD database. So a good number of them are previously identified. And it's really, at this level, it's not so difficult. It's, the probability they're associated is around 98%, 99%. So from a qualitative standpoint, one could look at the field and say, obviously that's the counterpart. But
did you get binary star?
I'm not sure.
Because that moves faster than that.
That's actually a substantial systematic uncertainty in this approach. And that is that the USNO A2 is a plate scan of Palomar plates, which are taken in 1987. So high proper motion stars, one which has greater than a half arc second a year, for example, will be at a totally different position than the X-ray source taken in 1991. And so that does produce a systematic uncertainty that one has to keep in mind. That results in an unidentification. You end up with an X-ray source which has no identification, but not a misidentification. Okay, so the results of all of that, just so we can show you, since I told you that I would.
So, are these high probability IDs basically very bright optical?
Absolutely.
The reason why you can say it's very high probability is that you have some unusually bright optical.
Yes, absolutely. It's because they're unusually bright and they're unusually close. To use Omer's method, one could look at the field, and really, if you're looking at a large enough field, which covers like 10 error boxes, say, you look at it and you'd see the brightest object right smack dab in the center.
Okay, but then is this because you expect to yield many old stars?
Well, so the probability identification gives you the sources that are, that it tells you what the probability of association is between the X-ray source and any given optical source. What you end up with, though, what one's searching for in the search for the isolated old neutron stars are sources that have no such optical.
I guess why we didn't give the FX to F opt of the Rosat flux limit divided by the B magnitude limit of the Calla.
Yeah, it's but actually the pertinent one, it depends on the probability cutoff that you're using. At the flux limit of the catalog, that's at around 0.3 X-ray to optical ratio, around 0.3 the Rosat bright source catalog to the USNO A2 catalog. So just identifying it within the USNO A2 catalog is not sufficient to argue, or not identifying it with the USNO A2 catalog is not sufficient to argue that any of the sources are isolated old neutron stars.
Okay.
But it does give you a first cut. It filters out, as I'll show you, the approximately 17,000 sources that you don't want to waste your time on. Let me get to that.
So it's 17,000 out of?
18.
18,000.
18,000, so it's a big field, yeah.
So this is the field that we talked about before. Here are the calculated probabilities for some of the nearest sources. And what you find is that the object which is closest to the source, the probability of association just based on its proximity and brightness, around 24%. This one, which is further away, is actually comparable, around 22%, because it's optically brighter. And this one over here is 10%. This one, which is faint, is around 1. Here one, up here is 0.3. So those are the kind of numbers that you end up with. And what's useful about this is that, you know, when you know that the probability that this particular object is not identified with any of the optical sources in the field is around 42%. It tells you that, well, you know, this actually may have, it actually has some finite probability that isn't isolated on the neutron star, and it happens to be solved. But that's not really important for the argument at this point. So the result of all that cross-identifying, or these catalogs, basically of the 18,811 Rosette bright source catalogs, sources, we identify around 2,700 of them with probability of unique identification greater than 98%. The amount of contamination is actually kind of small, about 0.7%. That's just the integrated 1 minus the probability of unique identification over all the identified sources. Greater than 90% is around 5,400. And greater than 50% is around 11,300. I should keep in mind that at 50% limit, 50% of the time you expect that the X-ray and optical source actually aren't associated. But having these numbers around and being able to find the ones that are even less likely is what's useful. And so when we sum up the total probability of no identification using the mass bright source catalog USNO-A2 cross association, we find that roughly 34.2% of the X-ray sources in USNO-A2 don't have any counterpart or any plausible counterpart in the USNO-A2 catalog. This results in a solid angle or number three in solid angle at the bright source catalog limit around 480 per distributor. Work which hasn't been published yet, but I'll tell you a little about. We use the same approach, same method, same statistical method, but instead of using just USNO-A2, we use USNO-A2, IRS, and NBSS sources, so we're all above 40 declination. We actually check for doubles and triples where, you know, 2 optical sources, 3 optical sources, and a combined optical, infrared, and radio source, double radio source, is included as a possible scenario for a counterpart. And when we do that, we actually decrease the total probability of no identification in this sort of approach, around 6.2% of the total catalog. And this produces not really on the number of isolated or the number of unidentified objects at around 93 for Mr. Radio, the bright source catalog. These begin to be some restrictive numbers.
How much is there? You should probably include the Diagonal 2 catalog to get rid of those high propagation ones.
Yeah, that would be useful. It's complete down to a magnitude of around 10, and that's pretty good. It doesn't really get all our 98% sources, obviously, so that wouldn't.
It's just that you have some more, which you're sure about.
I agree.
How much does it depend on your figures of merit? So presumably you could use different.
One could use almost any figure of merit.
So
it depends completely on our figures of merit. The figure of merit is where the astronomy comes in. You have to make some sort of assumption about the kind of sources that you're looking at. In the optical source, you saw that we used that, we assumed that it was bright, we assumed that it was in close proximity.
How do you weight those two? I mean, what tells you? So
it turns
out weighted towards brightness more than, I mean, it looks like you're probably weighted towards brightness more than proximity.
No, actually, if you're using the probability distribution of the counterparts, then that's actually optimal for cross weighting. In other words, neither is weighted over the other. If you're using probability distribution, we've assumed that the probability distribution of the background is comparable to that of the counterpart and doesn't have a significant effect. In this later work, actually, we went on and used the flux distribution of the counterparts by simply subtracting the flux distributions found in the background fields from the flux distributions found in the on-source fields. And that is, it actually made no really significant difference in our results. So that's fine. Going back to the initial page, and to answer George's question. Oh, thank you. These are the isolated old neutron stars that have been identified. So the probability, so this PID is 1 minus P no ID. It should be a consistent notation, don't you think? But I don't care. I apologize. These are the values that are found for sources that are in the bright source catalog. The top source and the bottom source aren't in the bright source catalog, so we can't really talk about those. These two bright X-ray sources and also the somewhat fainter X-ray sources have probability of identifications that are around 0.7, 0.4. So probably no identifications of 0.3, 0.7, 0.6.
You're not going to pick these as interesting.
I wouldn't have pursued those, that's correct. But these were pursued for other reasons. These two were bright, so they decided to get a superior optical position. This one they thought was a galaxy, and well, it should have, because it seemed like it seemed like the galaxy was the counterpart. These two sources actually had no possible counterparts in the air boxes. That's not surprising. They were also selected for that reason. They were both in the Rosette Bright survey, which were the 2,000 sources at count rates greater than 0.2 count per second. And the approach that was taken there is they drew a big air box around those, around 3 sigma, and they looked for any optical sources at all. And these two don't have any optical sources in the air box, period. So it's not surprising that they come up as well. But in addition to finding those two, we find on the order of around 60 others that have probability of no identification of less than about 0.1. And for future work, we made a selection based on a number of criteria, including spectral softness, whether or not there was a high proper motion object within 2 arc minutes, whether or not there was an identified cataclysmic variable or X-ray binary, which tend to have high X-ray to optical ratio that wouldn't be caught in USMLE2, whether or not there's a galaxy or identified QSO in the field. After we go through a number of these sources, we end up with some smaller number that we decided to pursue with Chandra and AO2. These are the USNO A2 fields for a candidate isolated neutron stars that we're pursuing. Probability that there's no identification in the field is somewhere between 1 and 0.9. This one looks pretty probable, but again, the localization of the X-ray source, since it's actually relatively bright, and the faintness of the optical source, given a probability associated with only around 4%.
Definitely would be, well, if I had been in the Chandra tech, I would say take a spectrum of that star first. We need to fix that. That's such an odd. If it's such a small error bar, anyway. Or is it really outside?
Well, based on its brightness
I guess it must be.
It's got a 4% probability of being associated. Yeah. One could take a spectrum on the optical
source. You did get those, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we got
eight. Oh, it's 1 kiloseconds. Not exactly a lot of time here, so it's fine.
That was one of the comments. They felt that it was an efficient right. Approach.
I mean, you guessed for 4 months per source, 1,000?
1 kilosecond, 1,000 seconds. So that'll give us somewhere between, for the faintest sources, between 20 and 60 counts that we expect. Enough to localize it 2 seconds. And then we go to telescope, which we've already begun. Use imaging to find X-ray, or find if out of there is no optical counterpart there, or high X-ray to optical ratio counterpart there. Yeah,
basically, an optical counterpart means it has to be justified with a limited magnitude you're using, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to go back to the compost galaxy problem for the gamma ray burst.
Was your Chandra proposal entirely predicated on isolated old neutron stars?
It was all placed in the context of isolated old neutron stars. We pointed out that among the sources that we are looking for, we don't really know what it is we'll find.
Yeah.
So it's possible that we'll find something surprising, but we don't really know.
So are these native, they are all relatively bright X-ray sources, I guess?
These are all the bright source catalogs, so it depends on what you consider to be bright. They're all about 0.05 PSPC per second. So that's all I have to show to you. In conclusion, Omer, we're still looking.
I have to point out, of course, that all of those calculations were based on speed distributions which are no longer thought to be the right neutron star speed distribution, right? And David will tell you that, you know, we expected maybe one to a few isolated little neutron stars which are accreting from the interstellar medium in the entire galaxy. Mm-hmm.
Is that the current someone's done the redo?
Nobody's really.
No. The velocity distribution is still sort of evolving. I mean, figure out exactly what the low velocity end is, because that's what dominates the Bondi thermal accretion, because it's like one of those big cubes, and you know the weight of small v is really important. But the most recent estimates are that you can't have more than about 5% at most of the pulsar population moving at less than 50 kilometers per second. And that's the part that when you did your calculation, you took 40 or 50 is the typical from the Ostriker work. And so it makes a big difference to the numbers. And I think sort of numbers of 1 to 30 or maybe 1 to 100 are sort of more consistent with the best velocity distribution to be found up now. And that's not even taking into account magnetic fields.
But that shouldn't stop you from doing this, of course.
I'm not going to wait for you to sort out the velocity distribution before.
There are all sorts of problems. I mean, you're assuming the radio pulsars are representative of the neutron star population as a whole, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, and you've really got to pursue
there,
this.
There was a line on there on the plot from the Neuhauser Tripper of cooling neutron stars.
Right.
And at some point, I would guess that becomes a more interesting target than velocity distribution. Is that what that was?
Line down here. Yeah.
I guess you're calling it co-stars.
Right. So those are somewhat consistent with the numbers that are being calculated.
I mean, you took and turned around and said that the specific objects you were listing in your table were more likely to be cooling neutron stars.
That's true. What you can say is that they are consistent with the distribution of cooling neutron stars. And I think, that's certainly true.
But I guess this must really sensitively depend on really what happens in a million years or 10 to the 5 years. I mean, this depends on the part of the cooling curve where things are really dropping off, I would guess. George, have you looked at it? Or Dimitri, have you looked at it? My guess is there's a lot of slop in the prediction of how many isolated cooling neutron stars you would see in such a survey, just because it depends on when the photon cooling really kicks in.
And if there are any heating mechanisms or not.
Or if there are any heating, right. So.
Well, in the magnetar case, for example, any dissipation due to transmitted field to the core probably does freeze out quite strongly at the time of photon cooling, but then you can have prolonged lower level dissipation taking place in the crust due to actual Hall terms in the quantum, which are probably more important than actually ohmic effects. And that is yet to be quantified.
I mean, there is now three sources which actually have this very long spin periods. And I think they're pretty good candidates for sort of cooling magnetars, which are not cooling all that fast because of exactly what you mentioned. And that would make the remainder of the curve perfectly consistent with the cooling neutron stars.
Isn't it true, though, Bob, in some sense there's already a problem? So the cooling neutron star line is below the predictions.
Oh, well, it's like 4 omegas there.
Yeah.
Oh, so the error bar here is, there's their 1 sigma error bar.
Right.
So it's not inconsistent.
Yeah, but they're not more on that basis.
Until you get, anyway. It's a prediction. The prediction here is around a little over 1, right?
Sure.
At the limit of the Rosetta All-Sky Survey, and something less than 1 at the limit of the Bright Source Catalog. So they're around 4 or 5. max. You know, there are two that are that are that are.
This is solid to radian, right?
This is per. Oh, excuse me. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Excuse me. So a factor of 12. So that's more like a factor of 10. Excuse me.
So it's actually max.
Your channel sources, your AO2 sources, are they at all a wide range of galactic latitudes?
They tend to be away from the plane. And that's
away from the plane?
Yeah, okay. Because that's where the background's high. So there tend to be a lot of plausible, you know, objects that are in the field of the plane.
All right.